This is the third day of this August 2018 7-day Sesshin. We'll return to our text from before today. The book called the Zen Letters. It's just Zen Letters, and these are the teachings of Yuan Wu, translated by the Cleary brothers. We left off in the middle of a letter that now we'll pick up. Totally shed the obstructions of views and understanding so that you're like a person who has died the great death. Your breath is cut off and you arrive at great cessation and great rest on the fundamental ground. Your sense faculties have no inkling of this, and your consciousness and perceptions and sentiments and thoughts do not reach this far. It's talking about deep realization, dying the great death. When he says your breath is cut off, of course he's not talking about literally the breath, but this life of the ego, this life of grasping and dissatisfaction and is cut off. The fundamental ground. When Buddhism migrated from India to China, the Chinese translators had to find suitable phrases and words for the abstract concepts of Indian Buddhism, and the Chinese language is one that very much emphasizes concrete terms, and so this fundamental ground is what they came up with for the essential. The essential, it's an abstract word. And the Chinese made it the fundamental ground. Perfection, the word, the Indian word for perfection became round. And we said yesterday that our true nature became original face. So again and again, Yuan Lu reminds us that this essential nature of ours is beyond all of what we ordinarily think of as our this mind-body complex. Consciousness, perceptions, sentiments, feelings, emotions, thoughts. It's beyond all those things. It does not exclude any of those things. That's all part of our true nature, the original face. But it's beyond them. He continues, after that, in the cold ashes of the dead fire, it is clear everywhere. And among the stumps of the dead trees, everything is illuminated. Then you merge with solitary transcendence and reach unapproachable heights. You don't have to seek mind or seek Buddha anymore. You bump into them wherever you go, and they do not come from outside. It's marvelous, vivid image that Yuan Wu conjures up here. Among the stumps of the dead trees, everything is illuminated. The great death, the great rest, everything resolved. Continues, the hundreds and thousands of aspects and facets of enlightenment since time immemorial are just this. This is mind. There is no need to go on seeking mind. This is Buddha. Why keep struggling to seek Buddha? Whenever he says Buddha, and he's not referring to the historical man, it means Buddha nature, or self nature. If you make slogans based on words and sprout interpretations based on objects, then you fall into the bag of antique curios, and you will never be able to find this true realm of absolute awareness beyond sentiments. At this stage, you are free to go forward in the wild field without choosing, picking up whatever comes to hand. The meaning of the ancestral teachers is clear in all that grows there. In other words, all phenomena, physical things, mental phenomena, emotions, feelings, thoughts, this wild field, picking up whatever comes to hand, using, employing whatever phenomena we wish to. He says, what's more, the thickets of green bamboo and the masses of yellow flowers and the fences and walls and tiles and pebbles are inanimate things teaching the Dharma. The water birds and the groves of trees expound the truths of suffering, emptiness, and selflessness. Based on the one true reality, they extend objectless compassion, and from the great jewel light of Nirvana, they reveal uncontrived, surpassingly wondrous powers. Everything is teaching. Everything is manifestation of the Dharma. These three things, suffering, emptiness, and selflessness, these are the what in Buddhism are called the three characteristics of existence. And you see it. You see it everywhere. He says the water birds and the groves of trees, living things, inanimate things, what does he mean? They extend objectless compassion. Beyond subject and object. Another letter. Those who are determined to practice the way practice self-awareness and self-understanding 24 hours a day. They think of this and focus on this. They know that the one great cause is there right where they stand, that it is in sages without being augmented and in ordinary people without being diminished. In other words, it's no more in the enlightened and no less than in the unenlightened. They know that it stands alone, free of senses and sense objects, and that it far transcends material things. When he refers to the one great cause, he's referring really, it's a capital C, the translator makes it a capital C, a capital G, great cause. This is this reality that is beyond cause and effect. It's what Hakuin meant in the text that we chant at the beginning, which we recite before Teisho, then the gate to the oneness of cause and effect. That's it. Mind. He refers to free of senses and sense objects. In other words, not caught by sense objects and the act of sensing. True practitioners don't set up fixed locations in anything they do. I think that I would take that to mean don't get attached to positions. They are clear and tranquil with solid concentration, and the myriad changes and transformations never disturb them. They appear in response to conditions and respond as they encounter events, leaving nothing incomplete. It's a very advanced state. Clear and tranquil with solid concentration, and the myriad changes and transformations never disturb them. Change, just change, is great potential disturbance to us human beings. Change can be so unsettling, disturbing. It's very much what Zen practice is all about, is just learning to move along with change rather than being overturned by it. It's a Zen saying, great winds are powerless to disturb the water of a deep well. This is the direction we find, the way that we grow through long practice. It happens on its own. We don't have to think about deep or shallow. Just gradually acquire this stability, this rootedness. You should just be empty and quiet, transcending everything. Once the main basis is clear, all obscurities are illuminated. Passing through from the heights to the depths, the great function of the whole potential is in operation. It is like when a strong man flexes his arm. He doesn't depend on anyone else's strength. Then the illusory blinders of birth and death vanish forever, and the true essence, indestructible as a diamond, is all that shows. Once realized, it is realized forever. There is no interruption. Next letter. Right now, if students are in fact truly genuine, teachers can contact their potential and activate it with a single word or phrase or a single act or scene. What could be difficult about that? Genuine, what the translator renders here as genuine, would mean with, you could say, just completely open. That's quite a high order, to be completely open without the shell of ideas and concepts that we usually have around us. So much depends on the condition of mind of the student. It's a little that a teacher can do unless the mind is in a pure state. He says, the only problem is when your faculties are unstable and your consciousness shallow, whirled around and around like the wind in the treetops. True reality is shown to you thousands and thousands of times, but you still cannot mesh with it. How is true reality shown to us thousands and thousands of times? In every phenomenon. This, here, now. Sounds, sights, smells, tastes, feelings, thoughts, physical objects. Everything in flux. It says, therefore, in learning the way, what is most valuable is being true and sincere. It's a very rich word, as these masters use the word sincere. It means undivided. You don't have two things going on. You're not split with some agenda and maybe saying one thing and holding something back. You're just plain, simple, direct, sincere. Next letter. People who practice the way begin by having the faith to turn toward it. They are fed up with the vexations and filth of the world and are always afraid they will not be able to find a road of entry into the way. So here he is pointing to the state of disquiet that brings us to practice. Dissatisfaction. Feeling of being fed up, maybe even disgusted with oneself, disgusted with the world. Remember Roshi Kaplow, it's probably one of his books, Zen Merging of East and West, and has an autobiographical account there, or maybe it was just him speaking to me. But when he came to practice, he was he just had enough of what he described as the joyless pursuit of pleasure. People can spend their whole lives in the joyless pursuit of pleasure, misguided, thinking that pleasure will somehow satisfy. It's impossible. How can pleasure ever be enough? How can we ever get enough pleasure that we are sated? And then this word afraid, they are always afraid they will not be able to find a road of entry into the way. This is the fear that dominated my mind in the first couple years of practice, was that I would die before awakening. It's great promise that can come from such fear and disgust and pain, suffering. So it's the first of the Four Noble Truths. That's where change begins. Awareness of suffering. Lots of people are suffering. They're not aware of it enough. They're not aware of it in the right way. It turns them to do the work to change, to relieve, to free themselves of suffering. We have to reach that point where we're not just suffering, but we realize that something has to be done about it. And that itself is a mark of faith, that there is anything that can be done about it. Otherwise, it would just be despair. What is there to do? This is just my lot. This is just the way things are. That's a terrible state to be in, with no hope for change. Of course, everyone who comes to Sesshin certainly has hope for change. Otherwise, we wouldn't be enduring these 7 days of trials and tribulations. Once you have been directed by a teacher, or else discovered on your own, the originally, inherently complete real mind, then no matter what situations or circumstances you encounter, you know for yourself where it's really at. But then, if you hold fast to that real mind, the problem is you cannot get out, and it becomes a nest. You set up, quote, illumination and, quote, function in acts and states, snort and clap and glare and raise your eyebrows, deliberately putting on a scene. He is addressing, as so many of these masters did, he is addressing the kind of poseur of understanding. These monks who learned how to impersonate teachers, certain kinds of teachers, through theatrics like that, snorting, clapping, glaring, raising your eyebrows, putting on a scene. When he says, if you hold fast to that real mind, it really means if you get attached to the idea of this true mind or this enlightened state. The first order of business after any kind of awakening experience, even the faintest, is to get rid of it. That is, to forget about it. The masters emphasize this over and over and over throughout their teachings. It's nothing to hold to. Let it go. What's the alternative to letting it go? Well, dwelling in the thought or the memory of some experience. What is that? It's not Zen. We want to discard it. Move on. Leave it behind. When you meet a genuine expert of the school again, he removes all this knowledge and understanding for you, so you can merge directly with realization of the original, uncontrived, unpreoccupied, no-minded state. After this, you will feel shame and repentance and know to cease and desist, that is, cease and desist dwelling and whatever attainments you think you've had. You will proceed to vanish utterly, so that not even the sages can find you arising anywhere, much less anyone else. This is refers to the transparency of a person of real development. There's not the faintest odor of awakening or attainment around them. They're just completely plain and simple, with no air about them. I love this saying, I think from China, having some attainment is the jackal's yelp. Having no attainment is the lion's roar. That is why Yantao said, that's the Japanese version of that name is Ganto, for those of you who care. And that is why Yantao said, those people who actually realize it just keep serene and free at all times, without cravings, without dependence. And then Yuan Wu says, isn't this the door to peace and happiness? Again, there's the transparency, simplicity. Without cravings, without dependence. Dogen was referring to this state when he said, being able to look at flowers without wishing they were more colorful. Looking at the moon without wishing it was brighter. Just things as they are. People as they are. Acceptance. Concurrence with things and people. Next letter. The ancients worked hard for the sake of the one great cause. Their determination is indeed worthy of respect, and they served as an everlasting example for later generations. In that paragraph, I would single out the word determination. Determination. So the three ingredients for real attainment in Zen: great faith, great doubt, and great determination. Doubt meaning questioning. This is in relation to koan work, at least. But determination is something that we need, whatever our practice is. The determination to persevere, to see our way through every obstacle. And there are so many obstacles over time. We do this long enough. So many. Pride, discouragement, frustration, tiredness, confusion, to be determined to find our way through these Dharma gates without measure. And there's no magical feature to it. It's just if the need is strong enough, you'll be determined to persevere. You'll persevere. It's really so simple. It's just whether there is a felt need to keep going. When you set your body on the meditation bench, it is no more than silencing and emptying the mind and investigating with your whole being. Just make your mind and thoughts clarify and become still. The meditation bench. It's kind of puzzling. It's not only cushions that are used for sitting in Japan and China and Korea. When I was with a group of people at Bodhidharma's temple, Shaolin temple, we discovered to our surprise that they sat in, how would you describe it? They were raised individual basket-like things, sort of shaped like an egg cup. You make a soft-boiled egg in. So kind of a little bit wide at the bottom and then coming in, a little like an hourglass, and then it opens up on the top, and there was some kind of a cushion there. But it was concave. You were sitting in a kind of a little bit of a recessed thing. It was very strange. Okay, I've seen that. I didn't see anyone there sitting on a meditation bench. We have them here. We've crafted these benches that people who are in awful lot of pain can use to take the weight off. But I just don't know what he's referring to. And then he says something that could be startling to some people. A fine place to do active meditation work is amid confusion and disturbances. It's counterintuitive. It's counter to what beginners think, that you have to seclude yourself in the quietest, most remote place you can so you won't be disturbed. But here he's saying the opposite. When you do active meditation, you must penetrate through the heights and the depths without omitting anything. The whole essential being appears ready-made before you, and it no longer arises from anywhere else. It is just this one great potential, turning smoothly and steadily. Why talk any more about worldly phenomena and enlightened truth? In other words, why divide enlightenment from the world of phenomena? If you maintain a uniform equilibrium over months and years, naturally your stand will be true and solid. Okay, this is a reminder that there's no quick fix in this work, in the true work of spiritual transformation. It takes time. People who don't have the patience aren't going to last long. Luckily, doing the practice steadfastly develops patience. But nothing great has ever been accomplished overnight. It takes time. We've gotten ourselves into this fix. We've allowed the mind to run amok for our whole life, or lifetimes, I would suggest. We've scattered our attention, grabbing at every kind of thing that comes into the mind, constantly playing with our thoughts. How could it be done quickly that we could get beyond thought? Takes time to undo what we've done, to unravel what we've raveled. Untie the knots we've tied our whole life, our lives. Now this injunction, this suggestion that you do active meditation amid confusion and disturbances, I'm just reminded of how some people, when they first come to the center and they are sitting in the zendo and they hear the stick being used and then hearing people run to Doksan, they find this off-putting and disturbing. But what kind of results would it be if they depended on just the right conditions? If our work depended on having just the perfectly arranged conditions of silence, this is the great forger of strength is to be able to find in the midst of noise. To find this eye of the hurricane, and it's there. It's within each one of us. We can settle in deeply enough that we can find this great tranquility and inner silence, no matter what's going on in the environment. You will experience realization like water being poured into water, like gold being traded for gold. Everything will be equalized in one suchness, profoundly clear, real, and pure. This is knowing how to live. One suchness. Now that's a really kind of opaque word, suchness or thusness, sometimes you hear. It really means just things as they are, and every single thing complete, perfect, everything resolved, everything in place, everything just as it is. Shining, whole. Nothing lacking, nothing in excess. Just do not give birth to a single thought. Let go and become crystal clear. As soon as any notions of right and wrong and self and other, and gain and loss are present, do not follow them. Then you will be personally practicing with your own true enlightened teacher. Zen, Japanese Zen Master Basui put it very simply, cut, 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 cut. Cutting off the excess, the thoughts, the judgments, the overlay of concepts, notions, opinions. Cut, 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 cut. Of course, that requires awareness. We have to be aware that we're acquiring thoughts and all these other concepts. We have to notice it. Then once noticing it, then we can just return our attention to the practice we're working on. That's the cutting. He says, if you do that, what worry is there that this work will not be accomplished? You must see for yourself. little more here, another letter. Round and clear, empty and still, such is the essence of the way. Extending and withdrawing, killing and bringing life, such is its marvelous function. In Zen and Buddhism more generally, there is this distinction we can draw between the essence and the function. The essence, well, he describes it here as much as one can, empty, still, and then the functioning of this mind is everything else, the activity, the application of the essence, extending, withdrawing, killing, bringing life. When you are able to travel on the sword's edge, when you are able to persevere and hold on, when you are like a pearl rolling around in a bowl, like a bowl rolling a pearl around inside it, when you never fall into empty vanity even for an instant, when you never divide worldly phenomena from the Buddha Dharma, but fuse them into one whole, this is called meeting it wherever you touch. Oh, there's a lot packed in here. When you're able to travel on the sword's edge, that is a state of pure presence where past is cut off, future is cut off. This is the realm of no thought. Very difficult to dwell in this realm of no thought. It's because thoughts are so eager to intrude. So usually we just experience this in a split second or two, or maybe a couple seconds. Like being on the edge of a sword. When you're like a pearl rolling around in a bowl, like a bowl rolling a pearl around inside it. This is the fluid nature of the mind. When we are in harmony with this non-attachment, things just moving without friction. When you never fall into empty vanity, even for an instant. Well, this we can take as just thoughts of I, me, and my. That's also a very advanced state. You don't fall into empty vanity even for an instant. When you never divide worldly phenomena from the Buddha Dharma, but fuse them into one whole. Such a mistake to think as of the Dharma as something apart from this, everything around us, ourselves, our thoughts, emotions, feelings, our words, our moving about. It's all the Buddha Dharma. How could we possibly separate ourselves in our mind, think that we are apart from the Buddha Dharma? We are the Buddha Dharma. Everything we do. You appear and disappear and move freely in all directions, and there is never anything external, nothing apart from us. You are clean and naked, turning smoothly, sealing everything with the fundamental. It is clear everywhere, complete in everything. When has there ever been gain and loss, or affirmation and denial, or good and evil, or long and short? This reference to clean and naked, authentic, simple, without affectation, without duplicity. This clear and naked. There's also what comes to mind is this phrase, stripping off the layers of sweaty shirts sticking to your skin. It's elsewhere in this collection of letters. That's the phrase he uses, stripping off thousands and thousands of layers of sweaty shirts sticking to the skin and opening through to awaken to the real, true, immutable essence. All right, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I bow to liberate endless blind matter, and I bow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind matter. I bow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind matter. I bow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain.